Two very different productions of Macbeth have opened in London in the past couple of months. One at Shakespeare's Globe is doused in gore, and Theatre Voice will be coming back to that on another occasion. The other is Cheek by Jowl's spare, shadowy essay in psychological anguish, with never a gout of blood in sight. Director Declan Donnellan and designer Nick Ormrod have developed Cheek by Jowl's intense, uncluttered style over many years and have an international reputation. This Macbeth has already been seen in France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands and Luxembourg, as well as in London, and after this week in Brighton it will go to Lille and Madrid, before it returns again next year for another tour. Will Keane and Anastasia Hiller play the Macbeths in a 12-strong cast. Well, my name's Heather Neal. I'm at the Theatre Royal in Brighton, where Will Keane has agreed to talk to Theatre Voice about playing the Scottish King. Well, Will, you've played a number of leading roles in, for instance, The Duchess of Malfi and Stoppard's Coast of Utopia at the National Theatre, Kiss of the Spider-Woman at the Donmar, The Prince of Homburg at the Lyric Hammersmith, Two Noble Kinsmen at the Globe. You also played De Flores in Cheek by Jowl's The Changeling in 2006. So would you say there's a particular Cheek by Jowl style or a particular approach that characterises the company and you're working with it?
Very, very definitely, yeah. It's unlike working with any other company, to be honest. For a number of reasons, partly because one of the great things about it is that it's a team of the creative team of Declan and Nick, and then Jane, who does the movement, and
Jane Gibson, yes.
And Catherine, who does the music, and Judith, who does the lights. Mm-hmm. The creative team have worked together for an enormous number of years, know each other extremely well, and they're incredibly confident and brilliant people who know exactly what their expertises are, and it's a sort of collaborative venture which I've never really come across anywhere else in theatre, that everybody is so brilliant at what they do and they are so precise about what it is they do and what they leave to the other people to do, and there's no sort of ego in terms of sort of delegation. I mean, in fact, working with Declan, one of the brilliant things is that a lot of times he'll say, I'm going to leave the room, make something for me, and then he'll come back in half an hour later when you've done some work with Jane or with Owen, the assistant director, or whatever. He'll have a look at it and then fiddle with it and have more ideas and whatever. But it's brilliant how they take distance from things and trust, above all, for an actor, what's lovely is they really trust you to create, and you really feel that you are part of the creative process. It's none of that thing of coming in on the first day and there's a model box there and you're told what you're going to wear. You know, all of that is decided in rehearsals, which is unique as far as I know. And you really do feel like you're all making something together. Mm. And so, obviously, the level of commitment in the cast feels incredibly strong because it feels like your thing.
So do you do any work yourself on the text before you come in, or do you all start?
Yes, they like the text to be learnt before, okay. Before any rehearsal. But yeah, I mean, this is always one of the sort of conundrum of acting, that you need to be sort of familiar enough with the muscle of the text, but not take decisions about, you know, how you're going to play things, because you need to feel fresh and alive. And in Cheek by Jowl very particularly also, I think there's a great emphasis on keeping things and not allowing you to feel comfortable as an actor. That as soon as things start settling and you start getting a shape to a scene, which is always the same shape, they quite rightly sort of move the furniture around in a way.
Ever is too much of that.
I think that's really important, that that there's a lot of work done on the transitions between scenes and the sort of choreography of the whole piece, but often there's a lot of freedom within the scenes for the actor simply to respond to whatever is happening in the moment, because it's all about being there, really being present, really.
Does that mean that when you came in, whatever idea you had of Macbeth had to be shelved and you had to start again?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think... no, I mean, it's so odd talking about character always, isn't it? That
yes, I know Declan doesn't really like that very much, does he?
No, and I sort of agree that... I mean, what we talked about a lot in rehearsals was the sort of the dynamics of the relationship between him and her, which I think was very important. And I think that what Declan was interested in exploring was one of the things he was interested in exploring was the sort of the way, as a couple, you can shift between roles in a relationship, and blame the other, and then take the blame, and play the weak one, and then play the strong one. Right. The way the sort of the codependence and the sort of symbiosis of a relationship, how that operates.
Yes, in a sense, and then there's a piece in the programme from Freud about how they could be seen to be part of the same consciousness, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And that is presumably the reason why we see so much more of Lady Macbeth than we would normally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She's even with you at the end. Just
yes, absolutely.
At the very end, in fact. You're sort of divided your personality between you, so that when one of you is wildly imaginative, the other is...
Yes, I mean, I suppose that is, all of that is something that is a sort of, in a way, an outside perspective, and and our jobs as actors is still very much just to be alive to the other person and just play and respond and be completely in tune with each other, sort of as individuals in a couple. However, I'm sure from the outside, I'm sure there is an effect of... I hope there's an effect of sort of singleness in a way.
Mm. I imagine that given this conversation, you didn't go into the usual backstory thing about how many children they have, etc.
Well, we did. Annie and I did talk a lot, sort of, quite a bit in private, and Declan would say, you know, you sort that out, whatever you need on that.
Right.
Because it is important to establish, you know, what happened to the child.
Yes, there obviously has been one, and they obviously haven't got one now.
So. Yeah, and what the sort of time scheme was, how long the war's been, blah, 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 all that stuff. I found very useful all the source material for the play.
Hollinshed.
Yeah. But all that stuff, I mean, it's curious, the research thing, that I often find it, that it's very exciting at the beginning of a play, going off and buying an enormous amount of stationery and and reading up and, you know, finding the maps of Scotland. And
it's because Macbeth was king for quite a while, in fact, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yeah. But it's actually sort of, it's sort of two different people conflated in any case, but more than two, in fact, but...
But then you find the.
But then there comes a moment when you just, you know, sort of do the text, really.
Yes.
And I think that yes, there are definitely things that you need to establish about the geography of the castle and where you come from the murder and you know, all that kind of stuff. But in a way, we were left to our own devices to work that out to the extent that it needed to be worked out. That's as far as the backstory went. I mean, it's one of the things about Shakespeare in general, and definitely in this play, is that he sort of starts where any normal writer would be at Act 5 already. So to be coming back from a war and having lost this child, returning to your wife, having lived that and having just got this amazing promotion, it's a very, very incredibly intense sort of the first act is very, very hard work because there's so much backstory there.
Yes. And what about those witches? I mean, we don't see the witches. Are they only in your head? Or no, not in time, because Banquo sees them.
I don't think so, because Banquo sees them. Banquo sees them. Yeah, no, I think they are very much there, but I mean, I would, because I see them.
actually imagine them?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I mean, I imagine them not as I imagine them as pretty normal. I mean, strange in the suddenness of their appearance, strange of them appearing here in the middle of nowhere. But three old and quite sinister looking women saying very strange things, and then who disappear in a very strange way, and who subsequently, what they've said is confirmed by the soldiers who come along. So it's a sort of gradation of strangeness.
Are they voicing an idea that's already in your head?
I think they must be. Yeah. I don't think they're just voicing an idea that's already in my head. I think they definitely. A lot of the play talks about the moment that something is. Given that a word is given to it, is the moment that it becomes dangerous, and that's the first time that it happens. But then, you know, having spoken about it to her before, because it's clear that we have discussed it before, that's the problem with being in the couple, that as soon as it's out in the open, that you can't run away from it. You've crossed the line. So,
in most productions and in most people's reading, Macbeth begins to cut her out as soon as the murder is over,
mm-hmm.
and say, be innocent of the knowledge, dearest Chuck, and all that, mm-hmm. and she more or less has mm-hmm. to ask to see him.
Mm-hmm.
Your relationship's very different from that, isn't mm-hmm. it? You're both, mm-hmm. You're still very interdependent for much, much longer.
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of, in rehearsals, they were very keen to make something of the sort of glee of when we actually become king and queen, because that's something which you don't necessarily think of in the play. We rehearsed not long after Obama had so there's quite a lot of reference to Obama, and they wanted to make the feel of this sort of this new dawn, this new, and they felt it was very important, which I completely agree with, that that Macbeth is the sort of golden boy of the nation. So there ought to be a sort of promise in it as well as a, and so there is a, yeah, we continue to be, it would be easy to start accusing her from as soon as Duncan's dead, and all of that scene just after it can be seen as a kind of accusation. But I think it's really important that they both are trying to cling on to each other. They're trying to carry on together. I mean, the big decision, of course, is then that he decides to kill Banquo on his own, and that's a decision he takes on his own, and suddenly that does really divide them. But, or gradually divide them. But I think that doesn't stop them wanting to keep reaching out to each other, wanting to keep saving the relationship. But the relationship is unsavable.
But late on, just when we're about to hear that she's dead, in mm-hmm. fact, she is with you, mm-hmm. you in your mind's eye, presumably,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that you're still feeling very close to her, needing her support.
Mm-hmm. Yes, wanting to... I mean, to the extent that she's in my mind's eye, that allows me to play the fantasy of the relationship rather than maybe what the relationship really is at that stage.
But they're both fantasists in a sense, aren't
absolutely.
They?
Absolutely. And I think probably he desperately wants to be able to comfort her, tell her that everything's okay. I suspect that it's a lot easier not to be afraid when somebody else is afraid.
Yeah.
I notice it on taking aeroplanes. I don't like flying at all, but if I'm with my wife, who's terrified of flying, I feel a lot stronger. And I think that I think the thing of having her there allows him to be able to play the sort of butch card,
right?
In a way that it's all under control. And although he does believe, you know, it's all levels of belief, this play, isn't it? On some level, he does absolutely believe that everything's fine, everything's sorted, and nobody can touch him because of the prophecy.
Yes.
I mean, one curious thing about the way the play operates is that it seems to, or maybe in this production, but I do sort of feel in general, that they sort of cross over, and it's difficult to tell at what moment exactly the crossover happens, but they cross over between him. He has a sort of inverse journey to her journey, where he feels in a way much more vulnerable at the beginning and does the act, which means he has to put on this incredibly strong mask and he becomes more and more armour-plated as the play goes on. Whereas she, I mean, it's a massive generalisation, but she sort of goes in the other direction. And there's some point in the middle where they sort of...
She can no longer keep her lid on it, as
well. Yeah, yes, absolutely. Whereas his lid goes firmer and firmer and firmer and firmer on.
Yeah.
Until she dies, really.
The word imagination occurs a lot in the programme, and that's the sort of word to sum up the whole production, really, isn't it? Because we're not given much to see in terms of props and so on to help us with the story. There's wonderful lighting and the acting, of course, and the movement, but nothing much in the way of costume or anything or black. Okay. So you have to get us to get inside your imagination. Is that a sort of challenge, or is that...
Definitely. I mean, it's as intense an experience as I can remember. It's very, very, very imaginatively tiring. Not just physically. I mean, it's very demanding. But it's
twice a day.
Yes, we do. Yeah, we've got two tomorrow, in fact. But it's imaginatively exhausting because you, if you drop a stitch, you've got nothing, and you really, really have to commit and create everything. I think it's, for my money, the most coherent idea I could imagine behind a production of this play. It makes complete sense to me to do it in that way. It's difficult as an actor because we get very spoilt doing sort of realistic plays or naturalistic plays. We get very spoilt with props that you can channel your emotion through, you know, fiddling with a book or... turning your wine glass or whatever, and you channel yourself through the objects a lot, and you can hide behind objects as an actor. Whereas having nothing there, and in a play which is so sort of nakedly emotional, and is very, very intense as an experience, very, very tiring. But I do, I think it makes enormous sense. I think it's tough to do, but it really does make sense with this play.
Do you have to prepare for it in a particular way before each performance?
We have we get together as a company about an hour and a half before the show, and we do a very one member, you know, different person every night does a sort of half hour physical, very sort of intensive physical warm up and a vocal warm up, and we play some games and stuff like that.
What about mentally, though? Do you have to prepare yourself mentally as well?
One always has sort of routines. Once I'm out of, you know, once we've finished the warm up, I'm sort of, I suppose, on my own. I always have a shower, sort of wash off the day, and but I don't. I sort of go through all the monologues, but I don't really believe much in. I sort of find it slightly dangerous, the thing of creating a state or something which you bring on stage, which is not. I quite I'm quite keen to be sort of as alive as possible, as sort of responsive as possible to whatever happens when it happens.
It's particularly deliberately choreographed, though, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, people do need to be in the right place at the right time.
Absolutely. There's a very strong physical framework to bits of it. But as I was saying...
Is that a liberation in that it gives you a framework?
Absolutely. As always, you know, limits make you much freer.
Yeah.
But as I was saying, the transitions and the sort of choreographic moments are very, very carefully and intensively worked. The scenes themselves... Annie and I particularly, in general, the scenes themselves, we've been left a lot of liberty just to feel alive to whatever happens. And definitely, I mean, one of the particular experiences of working with Cheap by Jowl, or any touring production, I suppose, but they, you know, Declan always says that the space is much bigger than the play or the production. So every new space that you go into is a new play, basically. And it's very important, not just to feel that there's a fixed thing which you just slot into any given theatre, because they're so different. It's so different the way the play responds in different spaces, quite apart from in front of different audiences going all around.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that, because you always play in English, don't you? So you have... people whose language... Do they have help with language?
They have surtitles.
Translation as surtitles.
It's wonderful playing to... And it's very interesting. You do feel very, very different natural, national characters, actually.
Yes.
Some
people get it, as it were, more quickly than others in different... according to country.
Well, I think they just sort of get it in different ways. It sort of sings in different ways to different people. I don't know. I mean, we've played in a few countries who have had dictators. And they felt very... and it's had a very sort of focused and intense feel to the audience. It's in very generally speaking... I mean, this is really generally speaking. The further south you get, you tend to get a sort of warmer, more vociferous response. That's a massive generalisation. It's really lovely to see how much other countries, you get really packed houses coming to see a play not in their language. Mm. And they're so receptive and so... generous and lovely, and it's really, really a privilege.
Mm. Can I ask you about any of the other characters, just a little bit? I was wondering, for instance, why Duncan is blind. Is that because he's lacking in perception? Is it?
I think the thinking behind that, in a way, was to do with vulnerability, and that Declan wanted to make the murder of Duncan unforgivable as possible. Mm. I mean, you know, it's unforgivable in any case, but there's something about the sort of... he wanted Duncan to be a really vulnerable, pure sort of figure to offset what it is that we do. And there's something sort of... there's something slightly divine about his blindness. There's something holy about Duncan. There's something graceful in the, you know, pure sense of grace. And I think that, Declan wanted to make him feel as vulnerable and as sort of childlike as possible. And there's something in blindness that gave that, I think.
Mm. And the porter,
yes.
A most unusual porter, a female red-haired Scot in a miniskirt, having problems with her intercom and her frisking devices. and also she is dressed so colourfully,
mm-hmm.
in absolute contrast to everybody else, because everybody else wears black.
Yeah.
So was this just because we really need a break?
Well, it's not really my department. I think that they are absolutely consummately brilliant at the rhythm of a piece, I think, and I think that they felt that there was, you know, after the sort of intense climax of Duncan's murder, that it was in the play it's important, the function of the porter. But there's always a difficulty with those Jacobean, Elizabethan sort of prose comedy scenes, that it is difficult in the modern day because it's so much about particular.
Yes, it's very topical to them, isn't it?
Yeah. And so you need to find an equivalent, a modern equivalent to that, and I think it's sort of completely appropriate, the sort of bawdiness and garishness as a counterpoint to that very, very dark world that you're sort of going into as an audience. I think it has a sort of a rhythmic reason behind it, and a sort of and it's a sort of contemporary equivalence for what the function of the porter is within the play.
Yes,
I'd say.
I suppose I have to ask you about superstition. You can't avoid saying Macbeth when you're in it, can you?
No, I am a very superstitious person, but I'm oddly not this has never been a strong superstition for me, the Macbeth thing. So no, that's not really been an issue.
And what about reviews? Do you bother about reviews, or do you just?
I try to avoid them. I simply loathe them. I think they are completely unhelpful to an actor. Either if they're bad or if they're good. I think they're possibly less helpful if they're good than if they're bad. So I try to
avoid
them. Because
it makes you self-regarding, or
even to the extent of somebody telling you after the show, "I really like that bit when you did
blah blah blah.
That definitely puts the curse on that bit for the next, well, forever probably. There's a sort of it's just very dangerous. It's a very curious thing how you have to listen to people's response to the play. And you simply have to accept it and just say thank you and move on in a way. Because if you go into it too much, it does in an odd way tamper with the integrity of the performance. And I, for what it's worth, I think reviews are. The danger of them is that they're in print, and print gives something a sort of an authority, which it doesn't necessarily have, because a review by its nature is an opinion. But what's dangerous about it is you see it in print, so it looks like it's the truth rather
than
an opinion. I try to avoid. Having said that, you can't avoid it completely, and sometimes it's irresistible, and you find yourself, you suddenly, and then you read two, and you think, why did I do that? I'm an idiot. Why?
You can't forget them once you've read them, I suppose.
Yeah.
Do you have to do something to, as it were, come down from it when you've come off the stage? It's so intense, isn't it? Have you got means of doing it?
Yeah, it does. I have a shower when I come down as well. and sort of washing it off is quite important. And a part like this where somebody... I remember I played T.S. Eliot once, and I had a similar sort of experience. Not that they're similar in any other way, but a part like this where you're really buttoning it away, that there's a lot about him at the end which is not allowing himself to go to that vulnerable place, not allowing himself to break down, not allowing himself to accept that he's lost his wife. Just pretending to keep on saying I've got it right, and I'm going to keep going, and I'm going to keep going, and I'm going to keep going, and I'm not frightened, that you do need to break. Sometimes it does happen in the play, sometimes it doesn't, and when it doesn't, you come off and you really need to you do need to sort of break that on your own, because you've been building it up inside so much. Oddly, no. I mean, I sort of thought it would be. I thought it would be tougher to wind down, but it's not really. You do sort of just get rid of it there. No, I don't go to sleep for quite a long while after it.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I can
but
imagine.
But apart from that...
Yes, yeah. It does... Well, it winds up everyone yeah. watching as well as everyone
yeah.
listening.
Yeah, no, it is very...
Because it's all in your head. I mean, yeah. it's not... we haven't been able to dissipate it by being entertained by
no.
colour and...
No, no,
and
no,
things.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And that, I mean, that again is the imagination thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really important yeah. that it does... that the audience has to work, that the audience
yeah.
does have to lend their imagination, and it is, you know, that's Shakespeare's... That's what Shakespeare's about, isn't it? That's what the chorus of Henry V is about, that
yeah.
It's really important, that idea of 500 people in a room all lending their imaginations to create their individual... dagger. They each have their dagger, and they all each partake of the sort of the community's dagger, which I think is that's you know, that's why we do theatre.
Yes, you imagine one of the critics. This isn't to do with the style of your performance, but mentions that you have an imaginary dagger, but we also have to imagine the real daggers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there a bit of a problem there?
Not for me,
no.
Because I'm probably the only one in the room for whom it's not a problem. Because for Macbeth, the dagger that he sees is as real
he
as
can the
dagger.
Anyway, yes.
Well,
perhaps
so,
that's the point then.
So I think that's I don't think that should be a problem. I mean,
we're not looking at any daggers, but on the other hand, you can see them all. So
I think
it cancels out.
You know. They're all as real as each other. I mean, yeah, or not real. Yeah.
Right. So you're going to Lille and then Madrid after this,
mm-hmm.
and then it's coming back, I believe. Are we going to see it again in this country?
We are. I'm not sure what the. All I know about next year is that we're going to New York in April. I think it is. They're building a sort of tour around that, which I think will probably involve somewhere in England, somewhere or in Great Britain, and some other venues, but I don't know where. But I don't know, to be honest, because they're still in the process of making it.
Right.
So,
does that mean that you're committed to Macbeth for what, another year?
I'm committed to absolutely to doing it next year. I mean, I think at the moment the plan is to do about. I'm not sure how long.
No.
I think at the moment...
But will you be able to do anything else between times? Or
I would very much hope to do something between times. Absolutely, I've got...
But there will be time, I mean. I'm sure you'll be asked to, but I meant you might not have time.
No. I mean, we've got off now. We now finish at the beginning of June, and we've got off until probably mid-February next year.
Right. Okay. Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of the tour. And for people who want to know about next year, they'll be able to look at Cheek by Jowl's website
Absolutely.
And find out.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, Will.
Thank you.